طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. In the waning hours of the Trump administration, the Israeli government issued a significant slate of last-minute settlement approvals, including granting of a tender for the construction of an East Jerusalem settlement, Givat Hamatos, long understood to be a doomsday settlement by those advocating for a two-state solution. Given the centrality of Jerusalem to the Israeli-Palestine conflict, what do these latest settlements advancements say about the state of play in Jerusalem facing the new Biden administration? How should East Jerusalem settlements, and settlements more generally, be understood in Israel's de facto annexation of Palestinian land? To shed light on these issues, Foundation for Middle East Peace has joined Jerusalem experts Zina Aga of the Middle East Institute and Daniel Seideman of Terrestrial Jerusalem. The Foundation's Kristen McCarthy, author of the weekly Settlement and Annexation Report, will moderate this discussion, which begins with her introductions.
Thank you all for being here. Good morning and welcome. My name is Kristen McCarthy. I am the Director of Grants and Operations at the Foundation for Middle East Peace. And I'm also the author of FMEP's weekly report on Israeli settlement and annexation policies. Welcome to a webinar today. We've titled it Jerusalem, Where Things Stand at the Start of the Biden Presidency. As you may know, and if you don't, you're soon going to find out, in the waning hours of the Trump administration, various bodies in the Israeli government advanced many plans for the construction of new settlements across the West Bank and East Jerusalem. That includes new construction, post facto approval of outposts, and the construction of entirely new settlements. Perhaps most brazenly and most emblematic of the Netanyahu government's readiness to challenge the new Biden administration on settlements, the Israeli government issued tenders for the construction of a brand new settlement in East Jerusalem called Givat Hamatos, which is located between the Old City and Bethlehem. For years, Givat Hamatos has been a bright red line for both the U.S. and the international community. Israel has flirted with approving this plan in the past, but has refrained from doing so out of concern for international blowback. That line has now been crossed, and construction of Givat Hamatos is now nearly inevitable, if I can quote Danny Seideman, who's one of our guests today. So today we're going to dive into these issues and why these last-minute settlement approvals matter and what they say about the landscape of Jerusalem that President Joe Biden is facing now that he's sworn in. We're so thankful for our experts joining us today to help us understand these issues. I'll introduce them in alphabetical order. First, we have Zina Aga, who is a non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute. She previously served as the U.S. Policy Fellow for Al Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network based in New York. Her areas of expertise include climate change and Palestinian adaptive capabilities, British and Zionist colonial cartography, and Palestinian counter-mapping efforts, and satellite imagery over Palestine, Israel, and Israeli spatial practices. We also have Daniel Seideman, who I'll be calling Danny, who is a practicing attorney in Jerusalem, specializing in legal and public issues in East Jerusalem. He is the founder and director of Terrestrial Jerusalem, an Israeli nonprofit that works to identify and track developments in Jerusalem that could impact the political process or permanent status options, destabilize the city, spark violence, or create humanitarian crises. Danny, you're up first. So help us set the scene. It has been clear since the get-go that the Trump administration ushered in a new era of settlement activity. So after 4 years, help us understand, where do things stand in East Jerusalem? Talk to us about the last minute settlement approvals that I mentioned in my introduction, that Israel pushed through in the literal waning hours of the Trump presidency.
What we have been witnessing is a progression of events, something of a strategic crescendo. And it doesn't start with the Trump administration. It was accelerated. Since Netanyahu assumed office in 2009, what we've been witnessing is a coherent strategic thrust to establish Israeli hegemony over everything to the west of the Jordan River. That means to create a unilateral so-called border between Israel and a Palestinian entity, an archipelago, in a way that is incompatible with any reasonable interpretation of a Palestinian state. It was being done by accelerated settlement activity, by security measures like the separation wall, by legal measures like blurring the distinction between Israel and the West Bank, by infrastructures. All of that led to a picture of not scattered events, but a strategic thrust. This is something that the Obama administration confronted. And Kristen, if you want to have a rather depressing moment, talk to Lara about the meeting that she and I had in the White House in 2013, precisely on this issue. It looks like the Trump plan. Now, with the Trump administration, what was problematic for Obama, albeit inadequately addressed, became the official policy of the United States, especially concerning Jerusalem. Take Jerusalem off the table in a way that, you know, defunding UNRWA makes refugees disappear. It began with the recognition and the move of the embassy. But if you want to know what Netanyahu's strategic thrust looks like, read the Trump plan, especially on Jerusalem. It's not merely that the plan designates Jerusalem, east and west, to sole Israeli control. It's the foundations, it's the perceptions. And the foundation of the Trump plan is the heart of occupation. It is the diminished humanity of Palestinians. In Jerusalem, Jews have rights, Palestinians have aspiration. Israelis have inalienable rights, Palestinians have needs, which can be bartered and bartered away. Jews have the right to self-determination, Palestinians far less. The message is Israeli lives matter, Palestinian lives matter less. And that is translated into very specific things. It's translated into the denationalization of the Palestinians of East Jerusalem. There are pages on Jerusalem, the word Palestinian is mentioned once. They're Arabs, they're Muslims. There's one national collective in Jerusalem, and it's Israeli. And this is backed up by the geography of detaching Jerusalem physically from any genuine connection with the West Bank. The Trump plan wasn't implemented, and it was maybe there was never an intention to implement it, but it continued. Normalization was the Trump plan by other means as it has played out. You know, Palestinians, what Palestinians? Marginal, not important. In the past few weeks, what we have seen is the implementation of the Trump plan on the ground through Netanyahu. It is a flurry of settlement activity that is translating on the ground what Trump put on paper. Actually, it was probably Dermer and Jared Kushner put on paper, but you know, we'll leave that for the moment. So this is all part of the same sequencing. Then something big happened. Givatamatos, as you have mentioned, is considered to be a doomsday settlement. It's just not just another settlement. It's been perceived universally that way by the international community. In March, October 1, 2012, Netanyahu approved the plan to implement Givatamatos 4 hours before he met in the Oval Office with President Obama. And they had a major confrontation because Obama knew exactly what Givatamatos was about and how devastating it was. On November 12th, until now, Netanyahu was deterred by the international community, even under Trump. On November 12th, he decided to release the tenders in such a way that they would come to fruition on January 18th, 2 days before the inauguration. Wasn't an accident, wasn't a mistake. This was done with malice aforethought. The opening of the tenders were delayed for a couple of days. They were approved 5 hours before the inauguration. There is no other way of interpreting that as a challenge, a gift of a gratuitous conflict and conflagration to the new president.
Zaina, I want to ask you about actually going back to an analysis that you wrote in 2018. You entitled that analysis, Israel's Annexation Crusade in Jerusalem. Still very relevant today, of course. So can you please set the most recent settlement announcements that Danny talked about in the context that you wrote about of Israel's de facto and de jure annexation of East Jerusalem land and Greater Jerusalem?
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me, and thanks everyone for spending your Friday morning or evening listening to this very depressing subject. I think, you know, the piece that you mentioned, actually, I wrote about the Greater Jerusalem Bill, which was, you know, sort of attempted to get passed in 2018. And like you said, feels very relevant today. I think context is really everything here. It's important to understand the sort of current plans as part of a broader climate of annexation through lands occupied by Israel since 1967, which are the occupied Palestinian territories of the West Bank, Gaza and Jerusalem, and of course the Syrian Golan. And the features of this occupation for the last 50 plus years have been land confiscation, demographic manipulation and population transfer. This is really at the forefront of what constitutes the occupation. So, you know, at the time of when the occupation began in 1967, just 20 days after sort of Israel occupied the outer reaches of Jerusalem, it annexed almost 71 square kilometers of land within the extended boundaries of the Israeli municipality of Jerusalem, which connected the old city, the Western Israeli city, what had been Jordanian administered city, and about 28 Palestinian villages and their pastures into one big metropolitan area, all in an effort to attempt to create a sort of unified, eternal Jewish capital. Of course, with the land comes the people, and about 69,000 Palestinians who were living on that land suddenly became, you know, engulfed into this greater Jerusalem area. And as part of the 1980 Basic Law, Jerusalem, the capital of Israel, it allows the government to essentially separate different areas of the city from the Jerusalem municipality while requiring those new administrations to still remain under Israeli sovereignty. And of course, this was clearly intended to discount 100,000 Palestinians who are living in these different neighborhoods and different areas, including the Shafat refugee camp in East Jerusalem, and positioning it in such a way to make them sub-municipalities, removing them from the census. It's all an attempt to gerrymander demographics, which, as we know, has been an obsession of the Israeli state for decades. So I think all of this, all told, this speaks to a very deliberate policy of Judaizing Jerusalem. Since 1967, Israel has limited Palestinian power in the city, Palestinian ownership, Palestinian habitation of the Jerusalem area, while on the other hand, increasing a very strong Jewish-Israeli presence and control. So while Jerusalem remains the only officially annexed Palestinian territory since 67, although we saw the Trump regime try very hard to, sorry, we saw Netanyahu emboldened by Trump try very hard to change that. Different nationalist right-wing governments in Israel's history have always advanced for the full annexation of the occupied territories, not just Jerusalem and the Golan. And then, of course, you come to the matter of the settlements, which is what we're here to discuss today. But I think it's important just to flag, you know, before we get too deep into the conversation, that settlements aren't a sort of abstraction. They're a clear violation of Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. And the 700,000 Jewish Israeli settlers who live beyond the Green Line are in contravention of that. And it constitutes a war crime. But what we're seeing today in this conversation we're having isn't new. It's not seismic. It's not a kind of complete U-turn or reversal. It's nothing to... of course, it's something to worry about, but it's not something to panic about, because in many ways, as Danny mentioned, it was expected. It's been on the table for a very long time now. And it's consistent with a string of other attempts, including the Greater Jerusalem Bill, to really solidify and galvanize Israeli control over Jerusalem and its environs.
Thank you. Thank you for that background and that reminder that this isn't an abstraction. It's not a theoretical conversation. There's real world consequences to these settlements. So, Zina, I actually want to stick with you to go further into that line of thought. So I want to get your reaction to a recent statement and more generally what's kind of emerging as a consensus that we hear from public reporting. From the Biden administration, which is that there are no diplomatic breakthroughs on the horizon. Mm-hmm. That would seem to suggest a strategy of just managing the status quo or trying to kind of reverse some of Trump's policies as best they can. What's your reaction to that, this kind of managing the status quo? And not only what's your reaction, but what is the status quo in East Jerusalem that are living under, Palestinians who are living under Israeli control in Jerusalem? Dive into that for us.
Sure. I think, you know, a lot of progressives were kind of disappointed that Biden won the nomination, because Biden and particularly Kamala Harris are some of the most reactionary Democrats on the Palestine issue. What we're seeing here is, you know, a reversal to business as normal, except business which is entirely unsustainable, a very dishonest broker trying to negotiate some sort of peace treaty, the constant recycling of the peace industrial complex, you know. We've kind of gone back to that, the sort of abnormal Trump years, which felt like a storm in a teacup, but kind of we're right back to where we were beforehand. And what we're seeing is, you know, Biden's trying to reverse a lot of the Trump plans. He wants to reopen the Palestinian diplomatic mission that was closed under Trump. He wants to restore US aid to Palestine, mostly to support economic and humanitarian aid to Palestinians. Some things are staying the same. There's no intention of the embassy being moved back. The incoming US envoy to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, she's pledged to shield Israel from what she calls, quote, unfair targeting. And she'll also pressure Arab states, namely Gulf states, who have recently sort of normalized relations with Israel, to support Israel at international fora. So, some, you know, the more things change, the more things stay the same. I think what's important is actually Biden appears to have kind of checked out on this issue even before he's begun. I don't believe the administration will have time, will, or even capacity to push for progress towards resolving this. Antony Blinken, Biden's pick for Secretary of State, made it clear that Biden's future role in, you know, the issue will be very limited. There's sort of lip service to the two-state solution as usual, but, you know, he said almost explicitly that as long as neither party takes steps that will sort of already make, quote, a difficult process more challenging, there's not really too much to do. And it kind of mirrors European politics. This is where the EU has been for many decades now. And, you know, I've experienced this firsthand during policy work there and on a policy tour. Everything's kind of, let's keep things exactly as they are, let's not rock the boat. But of course, Israel has a total disregard for that. But I think, you know, just on the Biden point, even if he could wipe out all of Trump's really catastrophic moves over the last 4 years and restore things to what the sort of the status quo, or whatever we want to call it, the sort of the way things used to be, or the way that America thinks the way things used to be, it's still a pressure cooker. you know, the status quo is not a stable condition for anyone to be in. It's actually a very unstable, uncertain and reckless position for the US and for particularly those who live on the ground to deal with. And meanwhile, throughout all this, Palestinians continue to suffer. Their basic human rights are curtailed. There's no freedom of movement. Their right to life is compromised. You know, Palestinians are perpetually and perennially treated in this orientalist and racist way, where they're either entirely sort of dispensable and irrelevant, you know, part of the background, the sort of native on one hand, or they're a security risk or a terrorist threat and whatever else. And it's, you know, being treated as such as this demographic burden for the Israeli state, that all these decisions get made. You know, decisions that happen in Jerusalem are never with Palestinians in mind. Palestinians get the short end of every single stick. They have, you know, their provisions are less than their Jewish Israeli neighbours. Their quality of life is significantly depleted. And of course, they're cut off from the Palestinian body politic. And I think that's a really important point to make. Like, who are we talking about when we talk about Palestinian Jerusalemites? Are we talking about the sort of the villages, the neighbouring villages, the Palestinian communities on the other side of the apartheid wall? Are we talking about refugees? You know, the Palestinians who live within what is currently understood as Jerusalem are a marginalized group, but they're not an accidental set of actors. This was a very intentional way of separating Palestinians from the wider Palestinian movement, all with a view to weakening Palestinian grip on the capital.
Danny, I want to go back to you, and I want to go back to kind of what you were talking about in your opening about Gibat HaMatos specifically. So will you add to the picture you started to paint about the political context around the approval of Gibat HaMatos? And what is the significance of this plan? Build on that. What is the history of this plan? Why hadn't it been approved until now? And given what Zina just laid out, why do you think Netanyahu decided to make these last minute approvals before Biden took office?
Let me contextualize this a bit geographically. Gibat HaMatos is a barren, rocky hill on the southern flank of Jerusalem, between East Jerusalem and Bethlehem. Now, Israel, since 1967, expropriated about a third of the privately owned land in East Jerusalem, and we built settlement neighborhoods with 55,000 houses for Israelis. That's a lemon that we've squeezed dry. And Gibat HaMatos was basically the last available land to be coveted and taken. It took a long time initially. I've been monitoring Gibat HaMatos for more than 20 years. It was complicated, the composition of ownership. A lot of the land belonged to residents of Beit Tzafafa, some from Bethlehem. But there were Israeli developers who paid a lot of money to purchase from them. A lot was and remains church properties, both Greek Orthodox and Latin. And that also complicates things. So the planning process took forever. But by 2009, 2010, it was moving forward. And it became clear that Gibat HaMatos was becoming a feasible plan. And the minute that that happened, it also became clear that this was not just another settlement. Now, I'm speaking in the context of the ability of creating a border between Israel and a viable Palestinian state, contiguous. I know that's a problematic assumption today, but that was our assumption and it continues to be mine. And Gibat HaMatos was considered to be specifically deadly because it did two things. Number one, you know, Gibat HaMatos to its west is the large settlement neighborhood of Gilo, more than 30,000 people. To the east, Gibat HaMatos, 25,000 people. But to the north, Beit Tzafafa, up 14,000 Palestinians under Israeli occupation. Gibat HaMatos will, for the first time, surround an existing Palestinian neighborhood completely with Israeli construction, making it impossible to integrate that neighborhood and into any kind of Palestinian entity and end occupation. That hasn't happened before. And everybody who saw the map of Givat HaMatos immediately got it. In addition, it contributed to a buffer, detaching Jerusalem from its East Jerusalem from its sister city of Bethlehem. The two are intimately related. It basically is a built-up wall between the two. Now, as a result of that, for the last decade and more, this has been held up because the international community has spoken in one voice. So much so that even during the Trump administration, Netanyahu didn't dare do Givat HaMatos because he knew that having Trump's, having the back of Trump, Bolsonaro, Duterte, and Orban wasn't enough. But finally, he pulled out all stops. It did surprise me, Zina. I didn't think it was going to happen. Why he is doing this, I have to admit, continues to baffle me. You know, partially because he's imperial mode and he's fighting for his political life and trying to stay out of prison. But having said that, he needs President Biden on issues that are important to him, like Iran. Why stick it to the president before he assumes office? What I know that Netanyahu did to President Biden, trust me, President Biden also knows. And there's been a lot of talk over the last couple of days of how President Biden has picked up the phone and spoken to all sorts of world leaders. Netanyahu has not been one of them, and he's bristling at that. I can't imagine why the president hasn't called him. Could there be any reason?
Well, I'm staying with you, Danny, because thank you for sharing that. I always love to get your reaction. Something else you've told me recently is that the reaction from the international community to the approval of the Givat HaMatos tender last week has been more than just muted, but almost non-existent. So in the past years, even the slightest hint that Israel is going to advance Givat HaMatos, whether under Obama or Bush, so it's been bipartisan in the U.S., it elicited concerted engagement to deter Israel from doing this. So why do you think its advancement at this time has been met with near indifference? What does that say to you about where the international community is, in particular the U.S. and Europe, and where the international community stands with regards to settlements as a diplomatic issue?
Kristen, I think I was a bit misunderstood, okay? I detected a note of skepticism in Zina's words about how the EU and EU member states engaged or failed to engage Israel. All bark and no bite. But on the issue of Givat HaMatos, they've done a great job. They have conducted a sustained, coherent, articulate campaign with Israel, and it worked. I mean, Netanyahu did not approve Givat HaMatos, not because of Trump, but because of Merkel and Macron and others. I know that Chancellor Merkel personally spoke to Netanyahu on more than one occasion, specifically about Givat HaMatos. And in the weeks and 24 hours before the final approval, 17 member states of the EU démarched Israel, unprecedented. Now, if it were attached with bite, accountability would have been much better. But the member states of the EU, I think, did pretty good on this. What I did say is nobody in Israel gives a damn about this. You know, I follow this closely. Not one member of Knesset spoke out during this entire period of time about Givat HaMatos. when the tenders were opened and the Rubicon was crossed and the inevitability of the construction of Givat HaMatos took place, there was zero reporting of this in the Israeli press. Now, part of this is the clinical occupation denial in which many of my compatriots live. Occupation, what occupation? We're sipping cappuccino on the edge of a volcano. But some of it, I think, is ideological. Givat HaMatos is bad. It's illegal. But if you're not looking for a border, it's just another bad settlement. I prioritized Givat HaMatos because I think the only way of ending occupation is a border. If you don't believe that, it's just another bad settlement. And it goes beyond that. I would say, even among my colleagues, in those who are challenging occupation, there's more than a fatigue. There's two-state agnosticism or latent one-statism. And one of my close friends, somebody who's done every bit as much as I in challenging in Givat HaMatos, asked me, "Danny, does this really matter that much? The Europeans are willing to re-engage." No, not the Europeans. Key member states are willing to re-engage. They're waiting for the Biden administration. I am afraid that it might be like waiting for Godot, but we'll see what unfolds.
All right. Zina, I want to get your take on the significance of these settlement advancements. And can you, if you can add for me too, like how are these settlement advancements perceived on the ground or received on the ground by Palestinians in Jerusalem? And then in the West Bank as well, including Palestinian leadership. And then we have a question in the chat that maybe you can weave in if you have anything to ask, but it's asking about the role of East Jerusalem institutions like Palestinian hospitals and what role they play in pushing back on efforts to disconnect East Jerusalem from the West Bank. So it's kind of a mash of questions, but if you can share some thoughts there.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is significant because it's another very egregious attempt to rubber stamp colonization and carry out a sort of very clear demographic gerrymandering. But again, I think it should be placed in its context. I mean, we should be mindful of the amount of settlements that have been built over the last, you know, half century. We should be mindful of the number of settlers who live beyond the Green Line. And, you know, kind of weirdly, what Danny just said, I think, does actually speak to a way a lot of people see this, which is a settlement's a settlement wherever you build it. I mean, it matters only if you abide by what the Green Line ought to be, or the significance of the Green Line, which is the internationally recognized armistice line between Jordan and Israel in 1949, and off the basis of which would be a future Palestinian state alongside an Israeli state. If you don't abide by that, and a lot of people don't, either because they're one-staters who believe in one democratic state, or because they believe they don't believe Palestinians exist, and, you know, it's sort of Israel from the river to the sea. In many ways, it's the same sort of logic, which is that a settlement is a settlement and this is another set of settlements. And I also think, you know, with regards to how Palestinians experience it, you know, the last month has been grueling for Palestinians. There has been a very bloody, violent period. And of course, it's, you know, not getting any of the decent attention that it ought to. But I mean, there have been dozens of acts of violence. I think B'Tselem on yesterday said that over the last 5 weeks of its research, there have been 49 violent incidents, which include 28 physical attacks on Palestinians, which wounded 15 of them, including four children. There have been dog attacks. There have been, you know, running people over in response to, you know, and all of this had actually very little to do with Palestinians. It was an Israeli settler who had died in a car chase with Israeli police. And of course, Palestinians are the ones who suffer for it. This is the context in which Palestinians live. And again, I think, you know, we should be wary of separating out West Bank Palestinians, such as that category exists, and Jerusalemites, because there has been this very concerted effort to issue different permits, different, you know, on the point of hospitals or on the point of any kind of administrative jurisdiction, you know, separating who a Palestinian is according to where they are. You know, Palestinians with West Bank ID, even if they live 10 kilometers from, you know, from Jerusalem can't go for Friday prayers in Haram al-Sharif without a permit. You know, these are things which we talk about at length and are sort of stale now, actually, in terms of talking about the plight of Palestinians, because it doesn't really seem to have too much bearing in terms of where policy goes. But I think it's important to remember this is the context we're in. And I think if we just looked at the Palestinian Authority for just a second, Palestinians, you know, the officials have been very vocal and very confident that Biden can just rewind the clock to some kind of pre-Trump era, you know, where there's funding to the PA, where UNRWA money has been restored, where there's another sort of PLO office in DC, and a US consulate in Jerusalem. There's also the sort of fig leaf of elections looming on the horizon, which perhaps we can get to in the Q&A. But I think, you know, all of this doesn't actually matter. Palestinians, the PA has long had a crisis of legitimacy amongst Palestinians. Even if it was being more vocal about this, there's not actually much it can do because it's an occupied government. And if it wanted, Israel could march into Ramallah tonight and take over what it constitutes the Palestinian Authority. You know, this is significant because it's more theft of Palestinian land. But as far as I'm concerned, and I don't want to speak on behalf of my people, but I think as far as a lot of Palestinians are concerned, this is another settlement in a long and sordid tale of settlements from before 1948 and before 1967.
Great. Danny, my next question is going to get you to respond to that, to what Zina laid out. And I know we've talked about it many times, but despite developments on the ground, that you remain committed and vocal in your support of the two-state solution as the only viable way to end occupation in an equitable manner. Within that context, will you share with us and add to what you were saying previously about why it remains pivotal to talk about settlements as they relate to the two-state solution map, particularly in Jerusalem?
I'm a kibitzer and a rank amateur on most topics, with the typical humility for which we Israelis are renowned. I understand one thing. I'm the mechanic of occupation. I'm the shop you want to bring your occupation to if it breaks down. I know what makes it work. I know what speeds it up. I know what slows it down. I'm an expert on the mechanics of occupation. You know, I've spent my better part of my adult life trying to end it with meager results. Let's put it that way. I remain convinced that the only way that occupation ends is a border. I am a cultural and spiritual one-stater. I would love to live in a state in which Israelis and Palestinians were equal, genuinely equal. I think it's possible 20 years after the border goes up. But I do not believe that reconciliation can begin without the divorce being completed. Now, I'm discussing this with my specifically young Palestinian friends. This isn't ideology for me. Show me a way of arriving at equality in the framework of one state. Convince me. I just don't see it. Now, if that's the case, it means that it will be necessary to carve a border between Israel and a viable, contiguous Palestinian state based on the 67 borders with limited and agreed land swaps. It makes me sound like a goddamn dinosaur. I know. I know as well as anybody else just how impossible that is. You know, the one state, two state solution discussion is really important. But from my perspective, it's a debate between dead and deader. I don't believe that the one-state solution is achievable except by means of arriving at two states. I do not believe I'll live to see it. It is politically impossible. I cannot imagine today a trajectory in which it will become possible. I am willing to be surprised. I continue to believe that occupation is an existential imperative for the Jewish people, for Israel, and the Palestinians. So it is historically inevitable. And the job that we've been given is to try to narrow the chasm, today unbridgeable, between the politically impossible and the historically inevitable. I'm open to other ideas.
Zina, your turn. I'm going to ask you the same question, but I know you approach the conflict not through the two-state lens. So why do you believe it is important, even within an alternative framework, whether it's apartheid or settler colonialism, to monitor settlement activity, to talk about settlements in relation to their geopolitical significance, and to push back on settlement growth?
As I sort of alluded to earlier, I think it's important because it's a later step in a 100-year history of Zionist than later Israeli colonization of land. I mean, territoriality is the bread and butter of settler colonialism. It's the single irreducible element. You need land. And the fact that there happen to be people on it, which are the Palestinians, and how they fare directly relates to the land's availability. You know, it was always intended, Zionism was always intended to displace the local population, not to integrate into it as sort of immigrants would. And that has spatial consequences. You know, we've seen a century of these spatial consequences. And this sort of later settlement announcement is part and parcel of that. Colonialism is a unilateral affair. There's no symmetry of power or symmetry of responsibility. I think in the question, it's referred to it as a conflict, you know, but this isn't a conflict. It's colonialism. The conflict paradigm has led us to reduce the century of colonial expansion over the entirety of historic Palestine into a limited struggle of ending the occupation over only 22% of the entirety of the land. I mean, the fact of the matter is, as far as I'm concerned, occupation is a sub-issue. It must be addressed, of course, but only in one element in a much broader process of decolonization. And I share Danny's pessimism. I don't think this is a quick fix. I don't think it's going to be easily resolved. But I disagree with him. I think we already live in a one-state reality. Israel has some kind of control over everything from the river to the sea in a stratified system. You know, B'Tselem came out last week and called it apartheid, and that's an Israeli organization. Palestinians have been saying this for decades. You know, we live in a world where Israeli Jews are convinced that the international community will do nothing to sanction them. They perceive the status quo as more or less permanent and sustainable, even profitable, I would argue. And in fact, 2/3 of Israelis don't even believe that the West Bank is occupied at all. So I think it's important to understand what's happening today, not as an aberration, but actually as a continuation. And the work that we ought to be doing isn't just to end the occupation of Palestinian lands, but a wider, more systemic process of ending settler colonialism for all people. And I always sort of talk about this and I get a bit misty-eyed when I do, but I think this is not just a question of what's right or just for Palestinians. I think it's unhealthy for any society to live the way that Israelis and Palestinians are living. You know, it's a toxic system. Everybody to some degree or another suffers. Of course, there is no, you know, I'm not trying to say for a minute that Jewish Israelis suffer more than Palestinians in this context. Of course, Palestinians are the primary victims, part and parcel because they're indigenous, I think, apart from anything else. But I think, you know, when we have this conversation, we can talk about the occupation and we can talk about, you know, occupation is very useful, particularly from an international law perspective. It gives you something tangible to hold on to and to conduct, you know, your work from. But I also think if we keep phrasing it as Israeli versus Palestinian rather than colonizer versus colonized, there's not really a way forward. And actually, I think just being honest about what's happening is the first step to be able to resolving it, to my mind.
Danny, to you with this question, so what opportunities do you see today? I mean, you're always someone who's looking and thinking about the way forward. So where are the opportunities? Do you, dare I use the word hope and not use it in a disingenuous sense? Where do you see hope emerging? And with respect to construction in East Jerusalem, what's next?
Leave hope out of this, please. We're poker players. We've been dealt a deck of cards. It's a really shitty deck. We can whine about it, or we can say, okay, how can I leverage this deck that we've got into something? The Italian socialist Gramsci said in the 1930s, the old order is dead. The new order is struggling to be born. This is the time of monsters. Well, this is the time of monsters. The wane of American leadership globally and in the Middle East began well before Trump. He delivered the death certificate, and it's we're not unique. Nobody knows how the world works anymore. And it means that we have to, think anew. I mean, the philosopher of education, Dewey, once said that people think once in their lifetime and spend the rest of their lives filling in the gaps. We have to think a second time. And I don't blame people for not knowing. But I would suggest a number of things. Number one, reverse Trump. Treat the Palestinians as an equal national collective and put meat on those bones. You have equal equities and equal rights as a people, as the Jewish people do, no less. Explore something that I don't know quite what it means, but I think it's possible. You've had creeping annexation. What we need, deoccupation. Take steps that will cut to the heart of occupation and not merely toss trinkets to placate the occupied, which has been basically the approach until now. When I spoke out against normalization, I was treated as if I had a social disease, even by people who should know better. But normalization is here to stay. I'm sorry. I wish it were saved as an incentive for my compatriots.
Danny, would you define what you mean by that for our audience, normalization?
Netanyahu's approach throughout, and this is something that I articulated well before the Emirates, is give me time. The world will acquiesce and the Palestinians will submit. Normalization means that Israel can have the legitimacy it seeks and the integration into the Middle East while still occupying the Palestinians more than that by doubling down on the Palestinians. And here I agree completely with Zina. My friend, the late great Faisal Husseini, one of the few great people I have met in my lifetime, used to tell me when I was rather despondent, Danny, you Israelis are creating facts on the ground. We, the Palestinians, are the facts. And I have enormous respect for the steadfastness of the Palestinians. I know in East Jerusalem. I am impressed with the young generation of Palestinians who aren't taking the cheap way out. Look, we're not even talking about pieces of a puzzle. We're talking about shards of trying to put something together that will be coherent, that will create the framework or the basis that will allow us to proceed resolutely to end occupation. And any occupation can be, I'm open to all sorts of ways. The United States will be doing this in rebuilding its relationship with Europe, rebuilding the Atlantic Alliance. The cement is wet. We need to come up with ideas in order to propose them to the administration. I know that we're not going to be high priority. I wish we were. The Biden administration hasn't spoken out on Givat Matos. I more than anybody, Palestinians more than anybody should be infuriated. But my prime minister challenged the president who's dealing with a pandemic and the most dangerous insurrection since the Civil War. I can kind of understand why he doesn't want to have a fight with Netanyahu at the moment. Let's gather our forces. Think this is the time to think anew and to come up with proposals and not give up.
Anna, this is an important, it's about the old city and what's happening specifically in the old city. And yet another question that probably warrants an entire webinar just to understand the dynamics at play there. But can you give us a quick snapshot of where the politics, the geopolitics, in what's happening in the Old City for Palestinians right now, and how that fits into kind of the broader landscape, the temperature, the political moment we find ourselves in, Biden finds himself in.
I have to separate this into two different categories. The Muslim Christian Armenian quarters of the Old City are occupied, but they're occupied in the way that they were occupied in the night of October 9th, 1991, when I started dealing with this. The settler incursions into the Old City have not been terribly successful. They haven't been game changers. They're bad. Now, there are exceptions. There are the strategic properties that were or were not sold by the Greek Orthodox Church, the Petra Hotel, and the Imperial Hotel at the entrance to the Old City Jaffa Gate. Enormously important. And the situation there is very precarious. I would like to remind you that part of the Old City, like an important part, is Haram el-Sharif, the Temple Mount. And there I can be far less sanguine. In the last couple of years of the Trump administration, there was a strategic thrust to change the status quo. It appeared a radical change in the status quo was included in the Trump plan, transforming Haram el-Sharif, the Temple Mount, from a Muslim place of worship that was open to the dignified and respectful visits of non-Muslims in accordance with the decorum of the site, and turning it into a shared site. And that was continued in the normalization scheme. There was an attempt, a surreptitious attempt, to leverage normalization to do precisely that. Friedman, Ambassador Friedman, confirmed as much a couple of days ago in an interview, I believe, with the New York Times. Today, there is an accelerating erosion of the status quo on the Temple Mount. The relations between Israel and Jordan are at a low ebb, worse than ever they were since the peace agreement in 1994. And this is low-hanging fruit for the Biden administration. Netanyahu committed in his voice, in his words, to the status quo. The Temple Mount is a place of worship for Muslims and a place of visit for non-Muslims. Quote him. Reaffirm the status quo. The Jordanian custodianship with the Palestinians and the Waqf is not a matter of good manners. It is one of the pillars of the peace agreement between Israel and Jordan. Marginalizing the religious and nationalistic pyromaniacs who have shaped the discourse on the Temple Mount is something that is achievable, it's affordable, and it's consequential. And I would encourage the Obama administration to start there.
You have been listening to a forum sponsored by the Foundation for Middle East Peace, featuring Kristen McCarthy, Zina Aga, and Daniel Seideman. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم